Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wes Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetirregulars.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 154, live from the red carpet.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And hooray for Hollywood, that screwy, ballyhooey Hollywood. This is I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Bert Wolder.
And we are fresh back from, well, where else do you screen great movies and hobnob with some of Sherlockians in the theater and on the stage and screen, but of course, Bloomington, Indiana. Wait a minute, that doesn't sound quite right. Actually,
well, yeah, everyone knows it's the entertainment capital of Indiana.
Well, I'll tell you what, we were treated to an absolutely amazing cinema there, the Indiana University Cinema. Top of the line, state-of-the-art facilities there. But more importantly, we were treated to state-of-the-art Sherlockians who all flew in for the Gillette to Brett 5 conference hosted by our sponsors, Wes Express. You may recall in episode 145, we chatted with Steve Doyle about the upcoming conference. Well, now we have attended and we have things to report back. Before we do that, just want to remind you that show notes for this episode are available at show notes are available for this episode at ihose.co/ihose154. That's ihose154, all lowercase. We are available for comment if you'd like to drop in there and leave a comment below in the show notes or on ihearofsherlock.com or on any of our social network channels, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And, of course, we will not turn away an email. If you'd like to email us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com, we would be delighted to hear from you.
Yeah. We would like, we would be delighted to hear from you, particularly about this episode after you hear it, because we've devoted some thought to this. You know, this is one of these gatherings where the conference is fascinating and there are lots of speakers and people you meet. And in a way, it's kind of like a family reunion. But many of you, one of the things we noticed as we were there was that many of you were not there. And what we wanted to do was give you sort of an inside look. And that's why we've titled this episode From the Red Carpet, because we have had lots of little conversations with the speakers and other people who are at the conference after their talks. And we have assembled those today to sort of give you a feeling of what the conversation was like, who these people are, so you can feel really a part of it. So that's what this is all about.
Fantastic. And to give you a feel for what the Wes Express is all about, we'd like to take you to the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex.
Hello, In the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, we're looking forward to October 25th and St. Crispin's Day, when we celebrate both the Battle of Agincourt and the Charge of the Light Brigade. But you don't need to fear a massacre, because you have your copy of the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, the original, exhaustively annotated 10-volume edition of the Sherlock Holmes stories by Edgar Award winner Leslie S. Klinger, the most complete collection of Sherlockian scholarship and commentary ever assembled, bursting with scholarly annotations in a sturdy, signature-sewn, softcover binding from WessexPress.com. These are the days when the sun pours gold into the air and flecks of light float in shafts through waving branches. On this autumn afternoon, reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
I must say I was very disappointed to find no goats, no sheep, no stacks of hay, no home-bottled mead, no cast ceramic pots, nothing actually from. I think the problem was particularly the cheese. You know, there are a lot of import laws and import duties. They couldn't get that stuff through customs.
Well, that settles it then. We must have our next Sherlockian conference in Wisconsin.
Or in the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex, you know, we have to get connectivity there. And, you know, they're still struggling with semaphore flags. That was talk about a disruptive technology.
Indeed. Well, you know, we did disrupt a little bit with some technology at the conference this time around. If you had a chance to tune in to our live Facebook video, we were there on Friday evening. It is archived now, so if you go to our Facebook page, I Hear of Sherlock, you can find that video. We kind of interviewed people as they popped by and gave some quick impressions as to the surroundings and what we were up for. But we'd like to take you now through kind of a timeline of the weekend and bring you some of the interesting people whom we talked to.
Yes, and we started with the Lilly Library. We haven't talked very much about the surround yet so far, but the conference was held primarily at the Indiana Memorial Union, which is a wonderful hotel, conference center, gathering place. It's absolutely huge, beautiful old limestone building on the campus of the university in walking distance of the great, just, you know, sort of a 2-minute walk away from the great Lilly Library and also the wonderful cinema and auditorium that Scott mentioned before. And we began on Friday afternoon with a visit to the Lilly Library, where they presented some of their extraordinary collection of, particularly of some Sherlockian, particularly of some materials of real Sherlockian interest.
I'm Maureen Mariansky, and I am the Education and Outreach Librarian at the Lilly Library. Lilly Library is the Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Indiana University, Bloomington. This building was built and opened in 1960, and it was partly due to the generosity of J.K. Lilly, who was a businessman and book collector in Indianapolis, and he donated his collection of 20,000 rare books and 17,000 manuscripts to IU in the 1950s, and that's what led to the creation of this beautiful building. Now we have over 450,000 rare books in a plethora of subjects, and we have 8.5 million manuscripts. So we have quite an extensive collection, everything. We have American and British literature and history, children's literature, cookbooks, books on the history of science and medicine, travel, exploration, Latin Americana, early printed books, medieval manuscripts. We have literary archives like those of Sylvia Plath and Kurt Vonnegut. We have historical archives, and of course we have our film, TV, and radio collections, as well as a collection of over 30,000 mechanical puzzles, if you're interested in those. So, yes, we have quite the wealth of material, and we serve IU, we serve Bloomington, the state, the nation, the world. We have researchers who come or contact us from all over the world to consult our collections. And we are very, very dedicated to making sure as many people as possible can come in here and use our collections. And we have a very open access policy. All you need is curiosity, and you can come in and see things in the collection. So for the Sherlockians, we do have the scripts. We have a 1938 script, The Hound of the Baskervilles, starring Basil Rathbone. And we have 1939's The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, also starring Basil Rathbone. And these are just two scripts that are in. We have a lot of different film scripts in our collection that date from the 30s to the 70s. And many of them, they can be first drafts, like the one for The Hound of the Baskervilles. They can be final drafts, like the one for The Adventures of Sherlock. Several of them also have publicity photographs that are in with them. And they're a great way for us to be able to highlight these films. We work with the IU Cinema on certain partnerships with our film collections. And we're lucky enough here to have wonderful pictures of Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes that were included.
And have you had a chance to read through any of these scripts?
I haven't, and I really wish that I had had time to do that. I love Basil Rathbone, and I would love to read through these and see, especially this first draft of The Hound of the Baskervilles, because I do know it has notes in it throughout. So I would love, we do have a final draft of it as well, and I would love to do some comparison and see were the annotations on this first draft, were those what ended up changing, or was this just one person's kind of opinion? Making notes and asking.
Right. Well, I notice in looking through here on page 49 of The Hound, to your point about notes, there's a pencil note here. And this is a very familiar scene where Sir Henry, Dr. Mortimer, and Watson arrive at Baskerville Hall. And there's a huge pencil note here that that reads, he points out the moor, the mire, tells the history. And there's a line here, huh, the home of your ancestors. Which seems to track right next to Dr. Mortimer's line. There you are, Sir Henry, Baskerville Hall. So it shows a lot of the work in progress here.
That's one of my favorite things about our film collections is you get to see that work in progress. It's the same way I feel about the literary archives. When you have drafts of manuscripts, it's the same way with the films, being able to see them come to fruition, which is a nice segue, actually, to the Citizen Kane material. So we acquired the Orson Welles collection that we have in the late 1970s, and we have a large collection, a large portion of it that is about Citizen Kane and the production, and it's incredible. And the copy of the script I have out is the final draft, and it was Wells's own copy, but we have multiple others, and those who are well-versed in Citizen Kane know that it had a kind of controversial history in terms of authorship. So within our collection, you can kind of see these back and forths about creating this and writing it, and he went through multiple drafts and working with various people, and it's really stunning to be able to kind of do the detective work and dig into that.
And here on the script for Citizen Kane, dated July 16, 1940, you have the pencil signatures of George Calouris, Paul Stewart, Ray Collins, Agnes Moorhead, Everett Sloan, and a couple of other actors whose names I can't make out, but not Wells, but then it was his copy.
So everyone else signed it for him. Mm. Yeah, and we have just a selection of photographs that were, we have a whole box of photographs from the production, which is really stunning. My favorite being, there's one of Orson Welles with a pipe in his mouth, and he's behind the camera, operating the camera.
Mm, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for making all this available to us.
Absolutely.
That's one of the fun things about the Lilly Library, you know, the point that she made about being very open and making it possible for people to easily access and look at some of these rare materials. Among other things, they have a collection of Oscars. They have all of John Ford's Oscars, and they had one of his Oscars on the table with a pair of white cotton gloves. So you
yes.
put the gloves on and pick up an Oscar and have yourself photographed holding John Ford's Oscar, which is probably as close as I will ever get to an Oscar, unless it's Oscar Madison.
Yes. Well, I did just that. It was the Oscar for How Green Was My Valley, which is interesting because I had the occasion in another rare books depository to meet with a star of that movie. I was at Boston University's Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center, formerly the Special Collections Department, at a reception, and none other than Roddy McDowell was there, because his papers reside at Boston University's library. So, and he complimented me on the color of my tie.
So. Well, he has great taste. You know, Roddy McDowell was noted for so many things. That's really fascinating. I didn't know you'd met him. Yeah. But among other things, he's a great photographer. He documented a lot of Hollywood history as he was participating in it.
He absolutely did. A lot of those holdings are there. And, you know, there are certain letters and memoirs that are under lock and key there that he made a stipulation in his donation to BU, and that was that they should not be opened until 100 years after his death, because he was very protective of the secrets that his Hollywood friends confided in him. So, no gossip for you.
And what is that clock ticking? Is Roddy McDowell still with us?
he's not with us. It is ticking.
Oh, so I have a shot then at seeing some of these things.
Yeah. Now
I just probably have to live another 90 years.
You just take your Professor Presbury shots, that's all. I'm not aware of any connection to Roddy McDowell to the Sherlockian world, are you? I mean, it would be kind of a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of thing, you know. Roddy McDowell in The Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston, who starred as Sherlock Holmes in The Crucifer of Blood kind of thing.
No, well, I don't know, but you know, we'll really have to take a look, because it's not impossible that he was a subsidiary character or did some voice work on a Sherlockian cartoon. I mean, he did do voiceover work towards the end of his career. It's not impossible, but no, I don't remember anything.
So, well, maybe one of our listeners can fill us in there.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, that was on Friday, and you know, just it was really just gratifying to see some of those holdings firsthand. You know, there were some miniatures that we saw, miniature collection of the Canon. There were obviously you know, an original Beatons was there. Oh, the note that Sherlock Holmes supposedly left Watson at the Reichenbach Falls. That Conan Doyle included with the Final Problem manuscript was there. That was pretty humbling to see that in person.
Yes, that was fascinating. On display, they had a small piece of paper, I would say probably about 4 by 6, maybe a little bit bigger, in Conan Doyle's own hand. And it was exactly that, the note that Holmes wrote to Watson at Reichenbach. So it begins, you know, my dear Watson, so on and so forth. And there's a lot of speculation as to how and why that was created. Was it excised from a manuscript, or was it, you know, produced for some other purpose? But it's wonderful to see.
Indeed. Well, that was Friday afternoon. We, of course, went out to dinner, and then we went back to the IU Cinema for a screening of Without a Clue. This was the 30th anniversary of the release of this movie, and boy, makes me feel old, because I remember when that movie was originally released.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my father told me about that picture. You really must be old.
Well, I'm still anxiously awaiting the release of the Roddy McDowell papers. But it was
no, it was a great movie. I was surprised. I didn't care for it at all when I first saw it, but to see it in the theater with people who share your interest and to laugh at all the same things and to note the references to the canon. You know, when it first came out, I thought it was sort of a silly lampoon, but it turns out it's a lovely. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, I think you're just right. It was the prospect of seeing it with everyone in the same room. You know, it became that much funnier and more interesting when we could all experience it together. And it almost took on a Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of a thing, where we were talking back to the screen from time to time, calling out lines, kind of knowingly winking and nodding to each other.
Amazing!
Good old Lord Smithick there, always popping in. So the next day saw the actual conference kick off, and we were actually delighted to hear from Nick Utekin, who will be making a separate appearance on this program to talk more deeply about the topic. You'll be hearing more about this and his book from Wessex Press as it becomes available online. All I can say is, boy, we are extremely impressed with the book, and it's something that every Sherlockian should consider buying. But more importantly, our conversation with Nick was equally as interesting.
I think all readers of the Sherlock Holmes short stories, when they first appeared in the Strand magazine in England, their first impression could not but be that provided by the illustrator Sidney Paget. Of course, over here in the United States, Frederick Law Steele, I think it is all by general common consent, based his image on William Gillette. But the first people to see it was Paget. Now, I didn't... In my talk this morning, I wasn't making a thesis. I wanted people to make up their own minds. And, you know, I sort of did it in a sort of verbal way, and shouting yes and shouting no. And I think, by and large, I wasn't surprised by the results. And some stick out very obviously as having, and self-confessedly, Douglas Wilmer saying to me when I interviewed him a long time ago, that, yes, I looked like Sidney Paget's Sherlock Holmes, and others that way. So there is no question that all the obvious names, Sainsbury, Arthur Wontner, Wilmer, Jeremy Brett, maybe not quite, but there was an awful lot of Sidney Paget imagery in the Jeremy Brett productions. There are one or two absolute copies of Paget illustrations.
What's your own personal view about the actors that you consider to be most Paget-like?
Well, I think it would come as no surprise, and I said in my talk, Douglas Wilmer, the BBC 1964/1965 television performer, he turned up at exactly the right age for me. I was 13, and I reckon you can get caught at 13 by the whole marvellous world of Sherlock Holmes. So he remains, even though the portrayal was maybe criticised for being a bit cold, making him a little bit insufferable, he looks the part just gloriously for me. Arthur Wontner, and I haven't seen all the Wontner films, I have to say, is staggeringly Paget-like. I mean, it is. He walks off the page. Sainsbury has got a slightly thinner face, more perhaps like Conan Doyle thought of his Sherlock Holmes, and that hawk-like nose. The use of the word Red Indian, which is a very sort of strange use these days, but he used it, is pretty up there as well. So I would suggest those four are the major ones. Jeremy Brett, I'm going to leave aside on the Paget front. Basil Rathbone, my third cousin twice removed, as I like pointing out every now and then, is staggeringly good. The thing is, of course, for people, Basil Rathbone sort of transcends everything. He was so dominant, sadly for him, in later years, that you cannot think, you still, I don't think, in these days, 60 years on, more from the films, your first thought, I think, is of Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes, and Basil Rathbone picked up on Sidney Paget. There are one or two things that I didn't have time to make, and in fact, they're not even in the book. I mean, Paget's illustrations varied quite considerably. There are one or two where Sherlock is an ugly bastard. I mean, he's just not well done. There are others when he is beautiful. I mean, he really is. The unpublished illustration that we have used on the front of this book, the Complete Paget Portfolio, I mean, he is a very good-looking man, and it's a wonderful Paget portrait. But sometimes, as I say, he looks crap.
Well, what a great lot of fun that session was. You know, Nick describing, each actor, showing their likeness, and then asking everyone for an up or down vote. Paget, yes. Paget, no.
Yeah. And this is something that our listeners can do themselves, you know, because I'm sure many of you have easy access to these films is to, you know, take a little time and look at the pageant illustrations and do your own inventory. Which portrayal, which production do you think really bears the imprint of Sidney Paget, and how has that shaped your own perception of Sherlock Holmes? It's a very, very interesting exercise.
It is. It is. And I, you know, as Nick said, that formidable or forming age of 13, 14, that's about the age that I discovered the Jeremy Brett series. And, you know, in those early days in the adventures, that first string of productions they did, every episode, the credits rolled over a Paget drawing. And it was usually a Paget drawing that perfectly illustrated some of the scenes in that Granada episode.
So, yes.
Wonderful continuity there. Well, speaking of continuity, we also moved on to a presentation by Dr. Ashley Polasek, who has been with us on previous episodes. I think she was with us on the Woodhouse episode. She was with us again when we talked about the BSI book about the films of Sherlock Holmes. And she was on that Jeopardy thing we did with the Baker Street Babes on episode 70.
Yes.
A lot of fun. Well, her talk was an analysis of the approaches used in some of the filmmaking techniques with, I believe it was Granada and the BBC Sherlock, and then the original BBC Douglas Wilmer production, comparison and contrast in the filmmaking techniques there.
Yeah, yeah. Ashley's focus was how adapting a particular story had been influenced. I mean, when I heard about the topic, I thought it was a bit esoteric, but it was a great talk. Mm. It was about how adapting a particular story, and in this case, the six Napoleons to the screen, was influenced by the technology available at the time. And it was really interesting.
Well, the reason I picked the three versions I did, one, I wanted to focus specifically on British television because I wanted television technology that was actually a genuine evolution. So, you know, comparing cinema to television or American to British television wouldn't be a fair comparison. Those three versions are very distinctive eras in British television production. So the Douglas Wilmer program is an in-studio videotaped drama, and people who haven't seen it might be more familiar with the early Doctor Who, which was filmed the same way. And it's essentially performed like a play. The actors do everything in order, and there's not very much in the way of post-production editing. And what that forces the story to have to be told in a way that maintains the mystery to the end, which is a challenge. And so there are all these interjected things that, to the average viewer, feel like they're intentionally slowing things down. On the other hand, you can actually follow the story and maybe get to the mystery before Holmes does, which is one of the pleasures of reading Sherlock Holmes, is seeing the clues as they go along. In 86, I picked that one because that's really the point at which British television kind of catches up with American television and does all film rather than in-studio videotape and external location film, which was generally fed into the videotape. So Granada's series was all done on film, and it was a much more navigable, open, kind of geographically mobile production, and they chose to use that to allow Holmes to be much more central to the story. Instead of it being a crime story, it's a Sherlock Holmes story, and that's new and different, and it's, I won't say entirely up to the production technologies at work, but I think a lot of it is restricted by those technologies and then allowed by those technologies. And then really with BBC Sherlock, they are much more conspicuous in how they use their technology. So as you were saying, when you watch Sherlock, you are aware that something different is happening. They want you to notice when strange shots are happening. They want you to notice when they're using different kinds of effects and graphic overlays and all this kind of stuff. So they want you to be aware of that intellectual process that Holmes is going through. And actually, what you learn by watching that show is that it's a messy place inside Sherlock Holmes's mind. It's not the tidy sort of logical place that you would think it is. It's actually complicated and fast and weird and fragmented and hard to follow, which is what the show ultimately is sometimes. I think it's a wonderful show and it's an artistic show, but you don't get that really clear start to finish, this is the mystery, here are the clues, here's the villain, solve the crime, that you do in 1965. And I think that that's really down to the technology.
Yeah. And one of the things you pointed out in your talk is that while some viewers may look at the BBC Sherlock and find it hard to follow because of its fragmented nature, you pointed out this isn't an accident, this is by design.
Correct, yes. They want you to be aware of the technology at work, and they certainly are not trying to present a crime drama. That's not what Sherlock is. It's not what it ever has intended to be. It's a very deeply psychological show, and quite frankly, the human mind is a weird, messy place. And so the show, in attempting to show that, is kind of a weird, messy show, and that's part of what makes it charming and fun.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that strikes me about that is whoever would have thought that the Sherlock Holmes, storytelling and visual presentation that we get on television or film could ever be improved by advancing technology.
Yes, and as a consumer, I mean, it's odd because, you and I have both been involved in lots of media production over the years. I mean, I've been, involved in lots of script writing and lots of shoots for advertising and other things. So you can think to yourself that, gee, you must be pretty informed about all this. But I had absolutely no sense of how the shape of the story and the perspective of the viewer and your engagement in the story was shaped by technology as it moved along. And so to look at her examples and to see the clear differences in terms of the production values and her analysis and her analogy between the Wilmer Holmes and the early Doctor Who, I was very aware that the BBC Sherlock was a very different kind of experience, but I never took it apart to that degree. And so it certainly really enhanced my understanding and appreciation of where we are today.
Yeah. The magic of the Baker Street Journal isn't that it's been published for 70 plus years. It isn't that it's entirely volunteer driven either. The magic of the Baker Street Journal is that it fills a need in the Sherlockian universe. Because we have an intellectual curiosity that leaves us wanting more after we close the pages of the canon. Because we must know more about Sherlock Holmes's childhood, or about train timetables in Victorian times, or the inspiration for the Diogenes Club, or the official location of 221B Baker Street. Yes, we are creatures of knowledge who seek more information about our pastime, and the BSJ provides it. But the real magic of the Baker Street Journal is that the articles and artwork that appear in it are entirely fan-created. The reason that the BSJ can continue to publish after 7 decades is because of the passion, creativity, and tireless efforts by devotees of Sherlock Holmes worldwide. And it doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon. Now's the time to get on board or to renew your subscription. Visit BakerStreetJournal.com and be part of that magic today. And then we moved on to an interesting presentation that was in some ways a tease or a preview of the film that we would see at the end of the evening, the end of the Saturday portion of the program. Of course, we viewed on its 60th anniversary the 1958 version of The Hound of the Baskervilles, starring Peter Cushing. And Charles Prepelec gave a wonderful retrospective of Peter Cushing and his turn as Sherlock Holmes.
I think my interest in Cushing started when I was a kid, seeing At the Earth's Core, which is one of these dreadful films. And, from there it just sort of grew. You see him in all sorts of things. And, of course, you know, Star Wars, it's rather a memorable one. And from there, once my interest in Sherlock Holmes developed, I naturally gravitated straight towards Cushing. It was a case of Holmes first, then his Sherlock Holmes roles.
Now, in terms of his other roles, you just mentioned you see him in lots of things. Have you ever had any interest in Doctor Who? Have you ever enjoyed his Doctor Who appearances?
Well, I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, but no, I can't stand those two movies that Peter Cushing starred in. They were the only Doctor Who big screen productions, and they cast him instead of William Hartnell because of his higher profile. But he plays that same doddering old man thing that I find some of his weakest performance work.
Yeah. So tell a little bit about what you think made Cushing's Holmes special.
Oh, it's definitely his research and his own particular interest in Sherlock Holmes. That detail, as I said in the presentation, where he's correcting scripts, he's asking for very specific things on set, and his dedication and preparation for any role, it's really off the map when it comes to the Sherlock Holmes material that he did.
For our listeners who haven't been here to see your talk, could you just recount quickly his major appearances as Holmes? Because those were fairly unique. Is he in that regard unique among actors in terms of the multiplicity of those roles?
I would say yes. I mean, you rarely see someone on the big screen transitioning to the same role on the small screen and doing well with it. For Cushing, we have The Hound of the Baskervilles, released in 1959. Then we go 9 years ahead to 1968, 16 episodes for the BBC in their series, replacing Douglas Wilmer. Then you end up with him reading a complete unabridged version of The Return for the Blind. And finally, in 1984, you're seeing him as Sherlock Holmes one last time in his 70s. But he also has one appearance as Arthur Conan Doyle, of all things. But there are very few other actors that have that kind of impact on the world of Sherlock Holmes.
Interesting. I had never thought until Charles' presentation of the breadth of Cushing's portrayals as Holmes. And it was very nice to see that evolution.
It really was. And Peter Cushing is one about whom we haven't really spoken on this series. Maybe someone we should pay a little more attention to and revisit that topic with a future guest. Who knows?
Oh, I'd love that. I was a big Cushing fan when I was a kid, but I encountered him mostly in the Hammer Frankenstein
right.
series and things like that.
Right. And from Cushing, we moved a little farther back to Basil Rathbone. And not just any Basil Rathbone, but specifically the radio version. Folks that have followed along know that we covered Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce and their radio shows here. Oh, I think it was back on, what was it, episode 122? I believe.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That was the Rathbone and Bruce show, 122. And, of course, we covered Sherlock Holmes and radio back on episodes 68 and 69 with Bert Cools. But in this case, we were treated to an analysis of those radio programs, The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, by Terence Faraday.
Yes, it began in the same year as the 20th Century Fox films, 1939, and on NBC, the most prestigious of the radio networks at the time, and ran for 3 years on NBC, doing about 20-odd programs a year. The majority of them canonical cases, I mean, the actual adaptations of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And then the show went to a down market kind of, very similar to the fact that the movie series, paralleling the movie series going from 20th Century Fox to Universal. They went from NBC to Mutual, and the show changed in character, did a lot more pastiches then, and very few adaptations of the original stories. But in total, they did over 200 broadcasts. So throughout the war years, they were a presence on American radio as Holmes and Watson, it probably did as much or more to cement them in the minds of the American public as those characters than the movies did. But I came to him from the stories and from the Universal films, kind of the reverse. I got to know Basil and Nigel as Holmes and Watson from those movies being shown endlessly on television, and then discovered the vinyl and then cassette editions. And I bought, I can remember the cassettes coming out, I guess it was in the late 70s or early 80s, and I was just always anxious for the next one to come out, because these were just a revelation that they had done all these radio shows. And so it's just continued now, of course, with satellite radio doing so much old radio again. They don't do a whole tremendous amount of Rathbone and Bruce for some reason. I guess they don't have, I don't know exactly why they don't, whether there's a rights issue or something else, but definitely there are CD collections now that are just really amazingly well done. Well, I prefer the adaptations. I think Thor Bridge is a really solid adaptation. Very little jokiness to it, very little non-canonical material. In the excerpts I played today, both of them had non-canonical elements. There's no train chasing Watson and Holmes down the track in the Bruce Partington plans, but I can see why the adapters thought this would make an exciting little first act curtain. The musical elements aren't the same in the Speckled Band, but on radio, it was the perfect way to introduce the menace of the snake without being able to see the snake. The Thor Bridge one is just very solid and doesn't resort to any of that stuff. It does resort to the one thing that I mentioned in my talk, which is that Edith Miser would sometimes give Watson some of Holmes' lines, because in a long interrogation of a suspect, Holmes is doing all the interrogating in the story and Watson is relating it but not speaking. Well, on radio, throw Bruce a bone every once in a while and let him speak. I think that was her attitude.
It was fun to talk to Terrence. We should point out that he is a noted mystery writer. He's had a series of Sherlock Holmes stories in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and those have been collected in a new book that was available at Gillette Debrett 5, The True Stories of Sherlock Holmes, which is sort of Watson's, supposed to, the premise, I think, is that it's Watson's first drafts.
Right, right.
So I got a copy of that, but I haven't looked at it yet. I'm looking forward to reading that.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. I've glanced through the first story there. And, you know, this is one of those things that And we'll talk about this on a future show, I'm sure. It helps to have some familiarity with the canonical material first, because then you can draw great humor from it. So we will look forward to exploring that in greater detail. Well, it wouldn't be a From Gillette to Brett conference without some Brett. And, of course, one of the people who knew him best from the Sherlockian world was David Stewart Davies. David was with us all the way back on episode 33 when we paused to remember Edward Hardwick upon his passing. And David, of course, was well tuned in to the Granada productions, of which Hardwick and Brett were part. And he joined us to talk about Brett, of course.
The first interview was with Peter Cushing. It was when I was a university student, and I ended up writing a book about the films, Holmes of the Movies, and I wrote to my first actor, an actor I loved very much in not just the Holmes films, but Hammer, Dracula and Frankenstein films. And he very kindly invited me down to Pinewood Studios, where he was making a film at the time, to interview him. And so it was my first experience of meeting an actor who actually knew about Sherlock Holmes as well, which was wonderful. He wasn't just getting the part or reading the script. He researched it. He loved Sherlock Holmes as a character and actually was thrilled to be offered the part in The Hound of the Baskervilles 1958. 1920s. And that stimulated my interest in writing about the cinema. And Holmes and the Movies was my first effort. And then I did another book in 2004, I think it was now, called Starring Sherlock Holmes, which took it a little bit further up to that particular period. But when the Granada made the television series with Jeremy Brett, that stimulated me even more, and I started interviewing him, and so eloquent was he about the character and about his interpretation and about his love of Doyle. He was determined to bring Doyle's home to the screen. I interviewed him an awful lot, which eventually evolved into a book called Bending the Willow, which, dare I say, is quite well received and quite well liked because of looking at the whole series and about Brett's involvement in it.
Yes. And then at the last clip, there was a meeting in Edinburgh that sadly, because of his general condition, Jeremy Brett's health, he could not attend. But it was very touching to see and informative to see his deep connection almost to before the last year of his life with the character and also his passion for it.
Yes, he had a great passion for Sherlock Holmes, and it fluctuated slightly. The second interview stated, you know, that he was actually trying to warm the character. He was bringing a little bit more of himself into the character towards the end of the series. But yes, I think he knew, because in the last interview, as people would have heard, those attending, that he'd really reached the end of a major acting career because of his health. So I think he was fully aware that he would be remembered for Sherlock Holmes, as the Sherlock Holmes of his generation. He was glad to have a crack at it. But he very kindly said, there'll be someone along any moment now to take over the role and take over the reins. And, of course, only another 10 years later, it was Benedict Cumberbatch who did that. Yeah. But he was a very effusive and, to me, very kind man.
Well, thank you so much. You are the only participant, as was said in your introduction, who's attended all five of these conferences.
I feel honored and privileged, seriously, honored and privileged to be invited back every time with Steve. It's lovely to contribute. I think it's a joy for me to be able to do it.
It was lovely to talk to David. We should point out that his book that he mentioned, Holmes of the Movies, that first one, is really a lovely book. So I'm sure that's available at abebooks.com and others. There may be a new edition, but it's really good to hear David always.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that he is a regular, an attendee of every single one of the Gillette to Brett conferences because of his the completeness of his work, because of certainly his relationship with those in the production side of the house. But boy, if there is a more well-informed individual out there about Sherlock Holmes on the screen, I don't know who it would be.
And that gets us to one of the talks towards the end of the Gillette to Brett conference with Jeff Hatcher, who is the author of the screenplay of Mr. Holmes, which starred Ian McKellen just a year or two ago, and many other things, and a new play called Holmes and Watson that was presented in Bloomington on the following Sunday after the conference. And it's always great to talk to Jeff. We talked to him at Chautauqua. He has a marvelous voice. I mean, he has a voice that cries out for a podcast to be built around it or voiceover work. But he also had something really interesting to say about a new screenplay of his that's in production. So it was not, and doesn't have a Sherlockian topic, but sounds interesting nonetheless. So it was good to talk to Jeff.
I am Jeffrey Hatcher. I am a playwright and screenwriter.
And you've just given a wonderful, entertaining talk in your history of entertaining Sherlockian talks, which I think, well, began, as you pointed out, at Chautauqua and at Baker Street Irregulars. And you covered a lot of ground in your talk. You talked a little bit about Mr. Holmes and about the some anecdotes of Ian McKellen's makeup and other things, and also about Holmes and Watson. And this group is going to be seeing that play tomorrow. How do you view the reaction to Holmes and Watson? Are you pleased? Have you been surprised at all by some of the comments or audience reaction?
Well, I've seen three productions of it since it premiered about a year and a half ago, actually, in Arizona. And they've all been different in one way or another. One actually had a different version of the script, an earlier version. And when I showed up, I thought, gee, I did rewrites after that. But the director had gotten a hold of it before we were done out in Arizona, and had, I guess it had never occurred to him or to me to say, oh, do you have the most up-to-date version? I mean, he got by with it, but he's going to do it again in Florida. And I said, you got to do the one that's official, because there are just a couple of gaps. And I thought, you know, certainly somebody must have pointed that out. And he said, no, not so far. But it's interesting. One, the very first production was very expensive. Well, it looked expensive. The production values were big, bustling. It looked like you were watching Wicked or something like that. And the one I was just referring to was very spare. And you didn't necessarily believe in the set, but the set didn't tell you to believe in it either. It was impressionistic. And yet that seemed to work, too. And I've seen now at least one other version that is somewhere in between. So it's interesting, as always, to see what always works and the things that work better in one production versus another because of either tempo or casting or what have you. My worry always is if you get ahead of the story that's your main interest, do detach completely. Or even if you don't get ahead of the story, if you just don't like that kind of puzzle box. Because I know there was one review in one town. The town will be nameless. But the reviewer said, you know, it's not like we're dealing with Holmes and Watson's psychological relationship, their inner life. And I was thinking, well, no, there are lots of other Sherlock Holmes plays and movies and pastiches that do that beautifully. I'm just not in the business of doing that today. This is about a puzzle box. The whole thing is about watching a magic trick. And either you like that or you don't. And I think sometimes it's up to the play or the production to tell the audience, this is what it is, come along on this ride. If you've come for another ride, this may not be it. But so far I think it's broken in terms of good reviews. Audience responses have always been great. Obviously it's still a subject that audiences like, and I think they haven't seen this story before, so I think that's exciting for them.
You mentioned that there was a time early in the production history where you had to play a role. One of the things you didn't mention was how that affected the casting of the other characters. How necessary is it really to find people who look alike? And you adjusted your own appearance to fit into the part. But
yeah, but you can only adjust it so far. On stage, you don't really know how tall somebody is. Certainly you don't on film. Mm-hmm. There are lots of ways to, you know, the Alan Ladd stories. There are trenches. You build a door with a slightly lower frame. There are all sorts of ways to trick the audience. But on stage, I've always found, the audience gets confused unless you point out the difference. I met B.B. Newworth once after a performance of Chicago. On stage, she looks tall, lithe, moves beautifully. Backstage, you meet the woman who's like 5'1", 4'11", a very tiny woman. Why didn't I think that when I was watching her on stage with all these other actresses? So I think it only becomes a problem if the subject of the show is, are they similar, who's taller, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I certainly learned this because we got a few reviews when I was in it. They shouldn't have. They should have waited for the real actor to come back. But one review was like, well, he's a perfectly nice avuncular country doctor, maybe a Watson. I thought, maybe a Watson? Like, that's like saying, maybe I could play Q in the Bond films. They're like, maybe. But it just kind of put you in your place, you know. I do think, though, Sherlock Holmes is specific and original in a world of Watsons. And that's probably one of the geniuses of Watson, that we can almost all imagine being that. Not quite as charismatic, not quite as bright, not as dopey as some Watsons are portrayed, but everyone can be Watson.
Oh, I love that. Specific and original in a world of Watsons. That's a lovely way to conceive of it.
It might have been the way Conan Doyle thought about himself, and that's what made it pop, you know?
Yeah. That's a wonderful observation. One of the things that was mentioned in your introduction is that you, of course, are the author of the screenplay of Mr. Holmes, starring Ian McKellen, a Bill Condon film, but that there is another film currently in production with Sir Ian and Helen Mirren. Can you tell us anything about that film?
Yes. It's called The Good Liar. It's based on a book by Nicholas Searle. And I did the screenplay. Bill Condon directs. Helen Mirren, Ian McKellen, Jim Carter, you would know from Downton Abbey, some other lovely actors in it. And it's about, you learn this early in the film, so I'm not giving it away. It's about an old con man who cons old ladies. And Ian and Helen meet cute, as they say, early on, and then you watch the permutations. And, you know, they have great chemistry. They've been friends for years. They've acted together for years. The last time it was in Strindberg's Dance of Death in 2001. But they have a great chemistry on and off. They care about each other. They take care of each other in the scenes and around the scenes. And they, when they have at it each other, it's really something. You know, because you're watching two people who grew up in the worlds of the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre, and everything in their pasts, from Shakespeare to Congreve to the Greeks to all the, you know, all the other things they've done, from Helen as the Queen and Ian as Gandalf and Magneto, it all comes together, and two people in their mid to late 70s just start thrashing about at each other. And they have a lot of charm and affection, too. But it's a thriller, in a way. We don't know quite how to describe it. It's a thriller, romance, drama, I suppose. There's more feeling in it than I think a thriller might normally have. Certainly there's more violence than a romantic old person comedy would have.
Yeah. Well, part of the thrill must be, like so many films of Bill Condon's, the exploration of how a particular character came to be that way, what those experiences are all about.
Very, you know, I hadn't thought about this until this moment, but you know, when Bill did Beauty and the Beast, he gives Belle a backstory, forgive me, with her father and the death of her mother in Paris, which isn't in the original. So you're right. I hadn't thought about that before, that Bill very much is into how did this person come about? Is this person the product of the environment? Is it DNA? What have you? We were having this conversation just last week because we were thinking about adding some voiceover that was about that. You know, was Ian's character a product of a very specific time and place? Or would he have been like that no matter where he was born and how he was brought up? I remember Sławomir Mrozek, the Polish playwright. I think he was born in 30. And I met him in the early 90s. And he was, he's dead now, but he was justly praised for being one of those people who stood up to the communists in the 60s and 70s. But he said to a group of people who were kind of cheering him on in my hearing, he said, you know, if I had been born just 10 years earlier in Germany, I might instead have been the Hitler Youth. So I was lucky. And everybody in the room was shocked, like, well, not you. Oh, sure, I could have been like that. So that wobbly place of, you know, put me here and I'm okay, put me there and I'm not. That interests Bill. It interests me, too.
You know, Jeff is just one of those individuals. You could listen to him talk all day and not get tired of it.
No, and the new film that's in production with Ian McKellen and Helen Mirren sounds really interesting. Mm. So we've got a long wait because, as he says, that won't be in the theaters until November of next year. But really sounds interesting. So it was great to connect with him.
Well, overall, just, you know, a delightful conference and, you know, one that reinforces why we think it's important to get out there and interact with other Sherlockians and to do so, you know, in a setting, an environment that leads to more conversations, more enjoyment together, more questions as to what drives our interest, and certainly more opportunities to be collegial and share our hobby.
Yeah, Amen. And it was fun. You know, one of the things we should point out, we realized this at the end of the conference, how many of the attendees had been guests on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, and they gathered up on stage at the end of the conference so we could take a group picture. But we had a lot of fun, you know, just talking to people and having meals. We had some great conversations with David McGregor and his wife, and just so many other people. Bill Mason at lunch. It's very nice. Very nice. The social aspect is as equal as you just said is as important as the content.
Well, now's the time where the content you wait for is who we're giving the prize to this time around on Canonical Couplets. Now, you may recall that the last time we shared with you this canonical couplet, the secret rigmarole directly beckoned to legal assets of King Charles II. Bert, do you know which Sherlock Holmes tale that referred to?
Oh, of course. That's the Musgrave Lodger.
That lodger was summarily kicked out by Sir Reginald off to the street in a ritualistic fashion, making it, of course, the Musgrave Ritual.
Oh, I was close.
Yes, you were. You were. But we had a number of entries this time around. I think our scare tactics last time of letting people know we didn't have enough entries the previous time really worked in our favor. We had dozens upon dozens of entries this time. And as a result, we will spin the random number generator. There it goes, round and round. Where it stops, no one knows until that beeping comes to, lucky number 13, and that goes to Nils Gampert. Nils, congratulations. You are our lucky winner this time around on Canonical Couplets. We will have a prize sent out to you from the IHO's prize vaults. And that means it's time for the next Canonical Couplet. Get your ears ready, roll up your sleeves, because here it is. Those county magnates caused a lot of worry when Holmes went down to a holiday in Surrey. If you think you know the answer to this week's quiz, just send us an email to comment@iHearOfSherlock.com. The subject should be Canonical Couplets. We look forward to receiving your answer. Good luck.
Excellent. Well, we have done quite a bit. We have somehow managed to squeeze 3 days of activity into an hour of fascinating podcasting and awarded a prize. And I think now is the time to declare victory and head for the exits.
Let's do that. It has been great. And we look forward to having you join us once again on episode 155, where it's anyone's guess what Sherlockian luminary we will speak to. Until then, I am Scott Monty.
And I'm the dim Bert Wolder.
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.